Not the best. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Teeing It Up with CMB, the number one sports podcast in Southeast Metro Detroit. I'm your host, Connor, as always, with the beef in a new background. Vladdy, what's going on?
Yeah, I'm sitting here in a dimly lit hotel room in borderline middle of nowhere, Ohio. It's kind of in between Toledo and Cedar Point. Doing well. Where I've got some work testing to do this week, and then or at least it was today, and then tomorrow I leave for France on vacation, kind of leaving the rest of my team out to dry. But you know what? They approved this vacation 4 months ago, and we don't tech totally control when we're given access to these vehicles. So sorry, guys, I'm out. But I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm also doing well. Just chugging along at the 9 to 5 back in the good old state of the Mitten where this show is usually recorded. Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about, and I don't really have much to add on my personal front. So we can kind of get into it. We've got baseball to talk about, the postseason starting today. Tigers playing the afternoon after we're recording this. Yankees Red Sox are playing the exact same game right now. We're going to talk about the Ryder Cup and another year, two in a row now for the U.S. In their losing streak at the Ryder Cup. And then we'll talk about, of course, the week that was in football. So we could start with the baseball. The Tigers are in the postseason for the second year in a row. I think it's something I read is only the ninth time into the last 50 years. And it just doesn't have the same amount of buzz. We kind of said it last week. We were going to talk about the collapse that would be when it actually happened. It didn't really happen. It was more so thanks to Houston falling apart and the Tigers kind of getting a couple of key wins, to winning two of the last four there to close out the season. A little frustrating. They ended up winning in Boston Saturday night and clinching, and they benched everybody, or not really benched, but didn't play anybody on Sunday. Didn't even try to go for the home field advantage. It was either they were going to win the division if Cleveland lost Sunday, and we won, and we were going to host Cleveland. This is kind of the same situation there. Or we, if Cleveland won it all and we lost it all, or we lost it all, Detroit was going to be the wild card and have to go to Cleveland, which ended up happening. So they didn't even really give the team a chance. I thought that was a bit of an interesting decision, but I don't think it's ultimately going to really truly matter. You're going to play Cleveland regardless, and you've played Cleveland 6 times already in the last like 12 days. So they know what they're expecting. And then moving into the playoffs, they get the win today. Tarik Skubal does an absolute big dog performance. He goes into the eighth inning, gives up one earned, only 3 hits, 14 strikeouts. I mean, he was unhittable. I was only watching the box score because it's a 1 o'clock playoff game, which is criminal on a Tuesday afternoon. But there was a point in the game where it was 1-1, and the Indians had only hit the ball out of the infield twice. And the run they scored was infield single, walk, bunt, infield single. So it wasn't like they were squaring him up at all in that game. But now we kind of talked about it before we hopped on the air is. You only had to use 2 arms for Skubal going into the eighth. It's probably for the best because it's not like he can turn around and throw game three in this series because the first series is only best 2 out of 3. So you were looking at him probably, no matter what, probably starting game two of the ALDS if you make it there. So I didn't mind the decision for him to go out for the eighth. He was even striking guys out in the eighth. I wouldn't have hated if they let him finish that inning. He throws, I think it was 107 pitches in that game, so it wasn't even like an obscene amount. So he'll kind of be able to go on normal rest for tomorrow or today as you're listening to this. Casey Mize will get the ball. He's been great in his last couple starts. Like I said, Friday night, you probably blew one of his best starts in the season. He goes into the seventh with 1-run baseball in Boston on a Friday night, and he's really turned his season kind of a whirlwind of his season. Went from an all-star to back to what Casey Mize had been the last 3 years as a Tiger to an all-star level pitcher. Again, the ERA is around 3.8. Like we mentioned, only he had to use 2 arms yesterday, so he'll have a short leash and they'll really try to win, go back and try to win that game too, and not try to force a game three because that starting rotation, you don't really, I believe it'd probably be Jack Flaherty you'd send out in that game. And I don't have a whole lot of confidence, and I don't think they do either. And maybe save him for game one of the ALDS.
Yeah,
But that's it.
I'll just say shout out to the Houston Astros for not wanting to win baseball games at the end of the season the same way the Tigers didn't, and allowing them to kind of backdoor their way in.
Yeah, I don't get the. I don't really understand it. I know the like. I'd rather not make the playoffs takes, and like, there's their like. I have no buzz about this team takes. Is like, they're there. It, baseball, I think, like unlike some sports, you can get hot at the right time and just win. I guess with that being said, is what the Dodgers and the Yankees are in the World Series, one of the two every other year, pretty much. I know you had the Rays Diamondbacks the year before, but anyways, Tiger baseball, playoff baseball. Playoff baseball is fun, it's especially when it's not at 1 p.m. But it's going to be at 1 p.m. again tomorrow, so I don't know. Ryder Cup. Team Europe gets it done for the second straight year on the U.S. soil. What was the final score? What ended up being the final score now?
15-13 when they played out the last couple matches, but
13-13?
15-13.
Oh, okay. 15-13. I think the story of it is more so on the, I'm actually going to say more so on the U.S. side and some guys that you were really relying on to be top dogs to win everything and just came out very flat in the first 2 days. And there was really nothing you were going to do on Sunday. And they really tried on Sunday to make a comeback, to be able to, come back from what they did. I mean, Scotty, it was desperation mode Sunday afternoon. We could talk about Scotty Scheffler. I guess, where do you want to start, with the U.S. or the Europeans?
Honestly, I would start with the play Friday, Saturday. I think you can talk about the course and how they neutered it. I think you can talk about the differences between the United States and singles and the highlights of them being individually talented versus the Europeans in team competitions, where whether it's team camaraderie, whether it's the fact that 11 of the 12 European guys were locked in, they were repeat players from 23, and the only person they switched was a twin in one of the Højgaards.
Right.
Whether it's I basically would put it as, I think there's a reason why when you look at world golf rankings, you'll probably have more Americans higher up than the Europeans, but then when you turn around and when you watch the teams, the Europeans dust the Americans in the Friday and Saturday events. It started ugly again. It wasn't quite the 4-0 sweep that existed in Rome, but the Europeans played out of their minds in Friday morning. All of the moments, all of the shots, quote unquote, all of the putts, quote unquote, fell for them, and they went up 3-1. I think part of it might have been some of the US guys just didn't show up. Russell Henley was awful. Harris English and Colin Morikawa got beat 6-5, which is, I think, the second worst loss in Ryder Cup history, is what I remember
I would
seeing.
imagine the worst is the Scottie Scheffler Brooks Koepka 2 years ago.
Maybe.
They got beat on, I'm pretty sure they got beat on 11.
Fair enough. Yeah, but in the afternoon, I mean, you got a little bit of life with some of the new players, most notably Cam Young, who turned into kind of the
Yeah.
American star player and maybe the only one who can confidently say, I played good golf this weekend.
Consistently, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick Cantlay was kind of ice cold in the team events, but that wasn't enough when he gets to either play half the hole or is competing against two Europeans, whether it be in the morning or the afternoon. I mean, Tommy Fleetwood was lights out Friday, Saturday. I don't remember him missing a putt inside of 20 feet. It was just,
No.
everything was automatic. Him and Rory, they talked about it. The Fleetwood Mac team, that's what I think, 4-0, 5-0 now in their
Yep.
foursomes, their kind of pairing events where they just play so well off each other. Their games complement each other with maybe some of the risks Rory might take with his distance and some of the ability Fleetwood has to kind of recover should Rory's risk not pay off and he ends up in the rough. Speaking of the rough, I'll get to the course now, I guess. There wasn't any rough. I don't know if it was Keegan Bradley or the PGA, but they made Bethpage into a municipal course for these players for some reason and cut it down. I know everyone's like, oh my God, the Bethpage Black, and it's this super tough course, and here's the iconic sign, and it played nothing like it ever has in any of the majors. The rough was maybe a third of the typical length. I think they, for some reason, made the greens ridiculously receptive, even
Yeah,
after
I
the
heard a lot of
slope.
that was rain earlier in the week, but yeah.
But I think as I listened to more and more people talk, they're like, first of all, it wasn't even that much rain. And second of all, it never rained throughout the week. Rain on Thursday, I don't think that, unless it hurricanes, I don't think rain on Thursday should mean that you, by Saturday or Sunday, your greens still let everything bite and check. That I
Yeah.
thought that part where I'm not saying you had to set it up like a US Open, but I think they made that course ridiculously easy for a quote unquote big event in the sport of golf.
It didn't feel like they touched it up like as much as the Europeans did in Rome 2 years ago, where they specifically designed a golf course for a European team. The US was given the same opportunity and they kind of just threw up their arms and said nothing. And that's not on Keegan Bradley or the team, that's on the USGA, to be honest. But
Well, and that's where maybe I don't think the USGA is involved in this, but is it Keegan who gets to make these choices at the PGA of America? That's where I'm not totally in the know, but I agree where I think their logic was, we have better wedge players, so if we neuter the rough, even if our guys miss the fairway with bombs, we'll have a wedge in our hand and then
yeah.
we can control it. And not that didn't totally work, but just the Europeans were better than you, flat out, and you dug yourself such a hole that come Sunday, which Sunday was magical. That
Magical.
hour of matches starting to go and turn red, and you saw Cam Young start it with the 15
Yep.
footer, and then JT continues it with the 15 footer, and Scotty holds off Rory, and then, I mean, Bryson, I guess, gets a halve and keeps it alive. Oberg kind of won his before you got to the last two finishing holes, but you sat there and you're like, wait a minute, we've got red pretty much down the board, and the Europeans haven't clinched yet. And then Russell Henley shows up, and I'm not going to sit here and dog him because he did make a couple of great putts leading into 17 and 18 just to be up by one.
Yeah.
But on 17 and 18, he has a chance with two separate putts to win his match and kind of keep the momentum going in the US favor. And he left both of them short, and I think that's very tough because it's you didn't even give yourself a chance.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, though, you didn't give yourself a chance on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, we can't talk about needing to win 10 of the 12 matches just to have a chance because you've clearly forgotten what the entirety of a Ryder Cup is if that's what you're hoping for at the end of a tournament to try and win it.
Yeah, and you mentioned the kind of the role pieces for the US and not being the same, and the European having some consistency, but I'd argue what was the most disappointing was the top of Team USA.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Scottie Scheffler, the first ever world number one to lose his first three matches. He goes 1-4. You had desperation mode throwing your two most talented players on Saturday afternoon in Bryson and Scottie, and they got absolutely pounded. Like, Bryson DeChambeau had his moments. I think he was one and was he 1-3 going into Sunday? Maybe
Something like that.
1-2-1. But he was below 500. And on the other side, like you said, Fleetwood's one of the, probably playing some of the best golf in the world right now. He played like that. Rory McIlroy was a dog all weekend. We could talk about the fans getting in his action and him absolutely showing for a guy that I think listens to the noise a little too much and maybe affects it from him truly being the number one player in the world right now, which Scottie Scheffler still is. They just played 1-on-1. But he answered the bell. He can say this year was a success after, for his standards, what was many years of not accomplishing the ultimate goal. And he was able to accomplish the two ultimate goals this year, and that was winning a Masters and winning a Road Ryder Cup. And you could tell how much he wanted it. And on the American side, you're kind of in a weird crossroads where, like you said, 11 of the 12 guys in Europe were the same. That wasn't the case for the US. And you're kind of that super talented, big, sexy name team that you had in 21 at Whistling Straits with Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka. I'm missing
Bryson
some.
himself.
But what?
I was going to say Bryson himself coming off the US Open.
Bryson himself and just a lot more bigger names. I think a lot of those bigger names have kind of fizzled out. As I'm looking at some of the live guys, I'm looking at some of the older, maybe older names for the US, and you have this kind of smaller core of probably Scottie, Bryson, Colin Morikawa, like
Is Colin Morikawa part of the core? He was awful.
he was awful, and Justin Thomas, who I hate to say it, but the outside of Scottie Scheffler and Bryson, who only plays 4 times a year with the big dogs, those aren't the top of the line names that you're used to kind of having at the top, and they've had to kind of recycle and find new role guys. Like you think of some of the guys that were on that team in 2023, like Max Homa was on that team, and Max Homa is barely a top 100 golfer in the world right now. Like the turnover is bad. It begs questions of like I didn't like some of the Keegan decisions. I thought Scottie Bryson was a bit desperate. I didn't like how you could send, didn't think you could ever send out
English and
Ben.
Colin twice.
Yeah, that's yeah, them. Russell Henley and Scottie Scheffler just didn't make sense. I know that was kind of predetermined. And it's a tough line, but and he didn't play Cam Young twice after he did look so good on Saturday after Friday afternoon, but it's a really tough line as a coach of when you're losing of how do you stick to the plan that you've had for the year that you've been this captain now for these 3 days, or do you try to ride one round's worth of a hot hand where that could fall out of place very, very quickly? And there's not necessarily a right answer to that. Some coaches are just better at, or captains are better at it than others. And I didn't think he had his best weekend as a captain. And you know, it's tough. He could have been on this team. I think that was in the back of his head a lot of this event too. And at the same time, he will be 42 years old for the next one. You look at what the European team has right now, and that's consistency. That's skill at the top, and that's a consistent captain that's now will be the captain for a third straight time for them. And I don't think it's out of the question of Keegan Bradley to be the coach again, and I think he wants it. I think he's kind of it's not Zach Johnson. It's not that type of defeat. I think he's going to take it home to him more. And I don't know. I think you need to model the European team with some consistency, and that starts with the captain at the top.
I would agree there. I think you need to another thing, and I don't want to take an SEC thing, but I think you need to also change what this means to you. The whole concept of, oh, it means more for the Europeans. I mean, you watch them celebrate, and yes, it's easy to say this with kind of the recency bias because we've seen them win two straight, but you see all the videos of them celebrating afterwards, all of them going together, the little jokes that they hear throughout the week, all of it sticks with them all together. It's not just, oh, you know what? This guy was joking at Jon Rahm, so only Jon Rahm's gonna remember it. No, he said something to Rahm, and here comes Shane Lowry. Oh, you know, we're celebrating, and now we'll bring it up. And I think there's a difference in mental approach, not just maybe physical and practice, where in the lead up to this last week, we said, well, at least the US is practicing before this time and playing in the pro core. This will help them out. I think you need to be mentally engaged as well, and it needs to matter to you. And I don't know if it really does.
But yeah, and I'm gonna go blame it on kind of the turn. Like, there's too many good. It's almost a blessing and a curse that like I think your 6 through 12 guys in the U.S. is usually that much more talented, and you could go and name 6 to 18 guys on the U.S. a lot easier than you could on the European team, where they can kind of rely on. Okay, well, we're only gonna have 14 guys that really have a shot at making this team, so we're just gonna keep the same crew year and year and year. Year and out, and we can build what we want to build and make it what we want to make it, as opposed to the United States is kind of that juxtapose of turnover, of blessing and a curse, so to speak.
If we want to get to maybe slightly off the course, thoughts on the Ryder Cup crowd? I know that's been a topic of discussion.
I thought some of the stuff I heard was probably a little over the top, but like, I don't know, like, it wasn't anything that was gonna, I don't know, I was slightly disappointed in it. I think there's a way that, and it's yeah, I know it's Long Island and New York City people, and it's Americans in general, and They sometimes I think we in America don't know how to like chirp maybe and just go naturally to maybe taking it over the top and lacking the wittiness and just going for the straight just personal. So I was slightly disappointed with that, but I also kind of was like, it's a Ryder Cup at the end of the day. And it would it have looked as bad if you weren't getting killed? I don't know. So.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm not really trying to make this some big topic. I didn't really hear any of the oh, F you Rorys that were being said that were always there. I didn't hear some of the other stuff that they said. And if things cross the line into personal, obviously you can never be okay with that in any sport, much less a sport that tries to say, oh, look at us, we're gentlemen and we have honor or whatever the bullshit that they try and push for the average silver spoon. The other thing I might say, and I think that maybe this is the first time you can actually feel it, because I think whistling straights might have been too soon after COVID, but golf's popularity in America has changed the or maybe not changed, but has expanded the viewers and the fans of the sport. And I think that now when you're 5 years after this and the boom is starting to show up and you have different people who are actively engaged in the sport, I do think maybe you have a different level of or a different type of fan in the crowd as well. And I think that's maybe part of where some of the unruliness might have come from if you're a European and claiming this was an unacceptable crowd.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the comment I heard that was said when Rory did the FU to the crowd was like slightly worse than your average chirp. I don't like I didn't like but then I didn't hate the Rory yelling at the crowd either, to be honest. So,
No.
but we can move on to the football. That's kind of all I have on the Ryder Cup, to be honest.
Yeah, US has got some problems to fix and to football.
We'll start like we always do on Saturday, or well,
Friday.
Friday. Yeah.
Florida State, Virginia play an incredible game. They just kind of traded scores. Virginia thinks they might have won the game in regulation. Then FSU gets a ball that kind of gets tipped around. Receiver doesn't corral it.
Do
Then
their students usually sit that close to the field?
I was going to get to that. I have no clue, or maybe they assumed that because, hey, look, like we might pull this off. We're getting closer and ready to storm. But on fourth down, Virginia picks off a Hail Mary, and the students have maybe the fastest field storming any of us have ever seen. The Florida State receiver that went up for that pass was still on the ground by the time that the students were around him, and you thought maybe he got stampeded. Thankfully, he didn't, because people can die from that kind of shit. So that was
Luckily, it
just.
was Virginia, so there weren't that many people there.
Oh, dude, they came down in numbers.
I know. It was a chirp. It was actually a fairly good crowd surf. And they're having a fairly good season for them, too. So.
Yeah, but that was I just really wanted to highlight that for the field storming. That is the fastest I've ever seen students get on the field. I mean, hell, even in college basketball, where you're pretty much on top of the court, you still don't see them get on that quickly.
Well, so that was my thing is like they were on that grass hill, but it didn't look big enough for that to be kind of, I don't know. I don't watch a ton of Virginia football to know if that's where the student section normally is, but I just thought that was an odd setup, like that there's no fence, there's no nothing separating that. Like that's I
Agreed.
know it's Virginia, but that's still a power four school that like we should have a better setup than that.
Agree. To Saturday, you have to take me through here because I was at a wedding and I unfortunately got to miss all the fireworks.
Yeah, a rather sad Saturday, especially a sad ending to what was a great, great Saturday. I'll kind of start with the first big, some of the bigger games. I didn't get to watch most of the Ole Miss LSU. I actually didn't watch a single play of. Ohio State Washington was the first one I kind of paid some attention to. Impressive. I know it wasn't the offensive explosion like you've maybe seen from some of these past Ohio State teams, but They very much look like the best team in America, I think. I think that's a solid Washington team. You go there, your first trip on the West Coast, pretty good performance. I was impressed by that performance. That was only like a 7.5 point spread, and that game could have easily been 38-6, not just 24-6. So, moving on, kind of some of the boring scores that of teams I'll get mentioned. Indiana and Iowa played exactly the game you would expect a normal Indiana and Iowa team to play. Here's Iowa State. They get a big win. I think they're kind of going to be the team in the Big 12 with Texas Tech. I think it's kind of made itself into a two-man race over there. And then the only thing I have with LSU Ole Miss is like I had a hard time with this game because these are two teams that don't win these types of games. They've kind of been the two programs, I think, over the last, I'll say, post Joe Burrow era that just like haven't won the big one. And then they got to play and play the big one. And Lane Kiffin gets it done. That quarterback is probably, would you call him? I don't know. I was impressed by him. And then on the other side for LSU, it's kind of the opposite team of what you thought you were going to be this year. Yeah, Vladdy's making a choking symbol, and he's right. Nussmeier was very just okay. They didn't get it done when it mattered the most. And if anything, their defense was what carried them again today when it mattered, and the offense couldn't get scores. And it's the exact opposite of what you thought was going to be your identity. And I would argue that that's even scarier, even though, like, the complaint every year is that LSU just doesn't have a defense in the Brian Kelly era. And now you finally do. And the offense that was supposed to have a Heisman candidate quarterback goes 21 for 34 with 195 yards and an interception when it matters most. I'd be really worried for them because I just don't think they're going to be scoring with any of the. Watching Alabama and Georgia play, I don't think they're as good as those two teams. They're going to have to play. Their schedule is even like. They're going to play. Sorry. They're going to play Vanderbilt. They're going to play Ellis. They're going to play A&M, Alabama, and Oklahoma all again. God, I can't believe Oklahoma's fifth in the country now.
With no quarterback.
With no quarterback. But that, I think, I don't know. I was kind of happy for Lane Kiffin. And I think the one note that you can take away from this game. Whit Weeks, who officially is apparently dating Lane Kiffin's daughter as of this week, throws up in the middle of the game. That is probably the perfect symbol for what that performance was when it really mattered most for LSU. And other games before we get to the nightcap, that was two very good football games. The only other one we're talking about, Illinois and USC, that was a really good game. Illinois can score, and
Can Illinois score, or can USC just not stop anybody?
I don't think USC can stop anybody, and it's kind of their age-old Lincoln Riley issue, and that really sucks because Illinois comes off that horrible performance last week to Indiana, and they come out and get a win against a good ranked opponent. And for USC, you had a chance to. You got your first Big Ten win last week against State. The offense got to flex their muscles. You got to go into a team that was down and just got the crap kicked out of them, quite frankly, and you couldn't find a way to get a win. I know it was on a last second field goal, but very surprised. I actually thought USA was, or USA, USC was going to have too much Ryder Cup talk, was going to run away with that one when it mattered most, and that was a good performance. And then to the nightcap, Georgia loses to Alabama in what I'm going to call Ty Simpson's coming. I know he's 23, but his coming out party as the best walk quarterback in the SEC. He goes for 24 for 38, 275 yards and two touchdowns. He's a lot better than Gunnar Stockton. We'll just say that. When it mattered most, and I think we said this coming into the season, is that this offense for Georgia was going to go as far as Gunnar Stockton and these receivers. And you saw the issues that they had with Carson Beck, and kind of everybody thought Carson Beck was the problem. And now you kind of see that that's not the case. Carson Beck's lit it up this year for Miami, and Gunnar Stockton struggled. They have a hard time getting the ball around to different receivers. Chauncey Bowens had, I think, pretty much every single reception for them. Or sorry, that was rushing. That was rushing. I don't know. I wasn't paying too much attention to this game, to be honest. I watched it and had it on, and it was just my biggest takeaway is the discrepancy in quarterback play between these two teams when it mattered most. Obviously, Alabama kind of goes quiet in the second half, but that first half of football Ty Simpson played is probably some of the better football quarterbacking we've seen this year in college football. And we're going to get into a game where there was some pretty bad quarterbacking. And that's Oregon beats Penn State 30-24 at the Whiteout in Beaver Valley. James Franklin goes to 1-17 in games that he is playing a top 10 team in. I believe the stat isn't much better for it. I don't know. He's a favorite in this one game, so call it what you want to call it. I'm just going to read off some stats. Drew Aller goes 14 for 25 with 137 yards, two touchdowns, and an interception. And they came out this game, they came out flat. They relied on the crowd, and Dante Moore actually probably played a pretty good, what I thought was a pretty good first half. I'm gonna get mad talking about it, but neither team could really move the ball at all. You relied on your defense. Oregon was able to, I thought, move the ball pretty consistently the entire night. I know they only had, what was it, 10 points or 13 points going into the fourth quarter, but they moved the ball with some consistency, and you didn't. You relied on turnovers and defensive stops after kind of bending and not breaking to get it done. And then you find a way when it matters most to when you really like what frustrated me the most was Aller was terrible, but neither Singleton or Catron Allen, two guys that came back to be the best running back room in the country, had very particularly good nights at all. And that's partly on the offensive line, and that's partly on them. And I didn't like neither of them could break tackles. They ran for 32, 139 yards. Katron only goes for 54. Nick Singleton has 21 yards on 11 rushes, and they kept insisting on giving him the ball, even though it just wasn't working. Their longest run of the day was Drew Aller for 7 yards. It wasn't like these were chunk plays. They had to run the ball 40 times to get to that number. Just no flow, no consistency. And again, with the Aller thing is you went into the portal and got him receivers, and where were they? There was no separation on anything, and then you go to overtime, and he just makes the exact same play he made to end their season last year. I know this didn't end their season. I know they're very much okay and very fine actually by this one. It just frustrates me because you're sitting here in year three of him being the starter now, and it's the same issues. When the game matters, he's throwing balls to guys that aren't open, that there's multiple Oregon jerseys and not multiple Penn State jerseys where he's throwing the ball. Not only that, but he's underthrowing guys by 3 yards. It's not like it's bonehead decision making. It's just straight up not executing plays that somebody that is supposed to be playing in the NFL next year should be making. And you're not going to win big games when a guy turns the ball over when it matters most, when the guy can't execute basic plays. And that was the difference in this one. Dante Moore, I'll give him credit. Did he look like the best player in the world? No, he played a very good defense in a very tough environment, and he executed plays when it mattered most. And that was the difference in this game. And for Penn State, nothing changes. We're always going to lose these games. We're never going to be a top dog. It's just not in our nature. And I'm sorry if you don't beat Ohio State in a couple weeks. He's done. James Franklin's career is over here. This is the most talented roster, arguably in the history of this program. And he's going to find a way to go 10-2, be ninth in the country, and lose before we even get to the semifinals again. So that's that game before I blow a gasket here.
You kept yourself put together pretty well. So I'll give you some credit. A couple things there, and maybe this is where I'll lean to you. I think the Catron Allen Nick Singleton thing is something absolutely worth mentioning, and
Yes.
I'm going to talk about it maybe more so from a kind of NFL draft slash prospect thing where I've been very confused where, like you said, they came back, they pulled, let's say, a Travion Henderson where they could have gone last year, both of them. They both decided to come back. And like you say, we're going to cement ourselves as the OSU of 2024 with two guys who have great complementing skill sets. And we're going to sit there, light the world on fire, and get ourselves drafted highly in this next draft. And as I sit here and I watch, maybe not the games of Penn State, I haven't really been able to, but I watch prospect rankings and I look at kind of their output. Even before this Oregon game, they haven't exactly lit the world on fire. And I'm a little confused that maybe if you can provide some insight on what that is the offensive line worse? Is it a different offensive coordinator who schemes the run game in a different way? But these guys in what was a better draft class last year for running backs were going projected higher in kind of the way people talked about them. And I don't want to use mock drafts because we all know mock drafts don't mean shit. But the way they were thought of in comparison to a stronger class is better than what it is now in a worse class. And I'd like to figure out how we've gotten there.
Yeah, well, it's tough from that standpoint because going into this game, we kind of talked about like these were where these teams, who's it at where? Neither of these teams had played anybody, especially Penn State, hadn't even played a Power Five school yet. And so I don't know, how do you get a gauge off of that, like mock drafts and that stuff off of that? But you get it off of this. And Oregon, where I'll give Oregon credit from past Oregon teams, is this looks like a Big Ten version of Oregon's. That's a front seven that wants to play physical. They have what they mentioned him 700 times on the broadcast. BJ's brother is a linebacker,
Oh,
Ugovo.
Matayo or whatever his name
Yeah,
is.
his brother's a linebacker for Oregon and is an absolute ball hawk. He's everywhere on that field. He I don't know. Let's pull it up. He had to have at least 10 tackles in that game. Can you even pull that up on a ESPN app?
I think you can figure out who did what there. But yeah, I
Four
agree.
tackles.
How many?
Four.
That's not quite 10,
He's
but I know what you're saying.
two of them were for tackles for loss, and one was a sack, though.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely.
But yeah, I like this Oregon team. Here's where I'll play devil's advocate is against a good front seven and a good team, you didn't back away. You played good defense. This defense is a top five team in America. This offense is probably a top 25 team in America, which I think you thought was probably going to be the opposite going into the season, unfortunately. And I know I'm kind of off the Catron Allen, Nick Singleton train now, but they're I think those are probably two top five teams from what I've seen in the rest of college football still. They played an overtime game together. From the Catron Allen and Nick Singleton thing is you just got manhandled by the only real defense you've played. So I need to see more. I don't know. I don't even know who they play next week. They got a little while before the Ohio State game to get right. They play UCLA at UCLA.
Doesn't
They're a
even matter.
29-point favorite. I mean, come on. Then they'll play Northwestern, Iowa, and then they will play Ohio State on Halloween. Then they'll play Ohio State and Indiana. I kind of always forget that that's on that schedule. But yeah, been a brighter day.
Fair enough. To the NFL, is there anything left in college that you need to bring up?
Sorry. What'd you say?
I was just say, obviously, I was unable to watch a lot of the college. I was at a wedding all of Saturday. Is there anything else you want to bring up, or do we get to NFL?
No, I'll get to the NFL.
Oh, I guess last thing, Michigan State lost the bye week. We moved to 3-2.
What?
It started Thursday, or the NFL started Thursday, Arizona, Seattle. The
An
first.
unwatchable game that became very watchable.
The first half was a Marvin Harrison Jr. has some soul searching to do, where it looked like he was completely in his own head, and it looked like maybe he's seeing football adversity for the first time in his life, where up until the NFL, he was always the most talented player on the field and the most productive player on the field. And Maybe he finally found people who could run with him or match his route techniques, and he didn't know what to do and he couldn't catch a pass. And it got very ugly, and you had people booing him and people booing the team after every possession. And then in the second half, it kind of woke up and he catches this little fade, if you will, or just this pass into the corner of the end zone. And to be fair, he almost dropped that one too. It didn't exactly get vice grip by his hands. It almost went through him before he decided to hold on to it. But you see him get up and get to one knee, and he's just looking at the ground, and it looks like he's probably crying. I've never really seen that from a player. I don't know if that was just him not knowing how to handle adversity on a football field because he hasn't needed to, but I guess you want to say he got it together. Arizona had a chance to potentially take that game into overtime, and then our dear friend Chad Ryland does what anybody would do when the Cardinals need to find a new way to lose a football game, and he kicks the a kickoff after a Cardinals touchdown to tie it with, I think, 30 seconds left short of the 20-yard line, meaning that Seattle got it at the 40, and then they ran four plays or something, got 26 yards, and set up a game-winning field goal. I think the biggest talking points, because I mean, Marvin Harrison could have been a talking point had he not gotten involved in that game, and I think he needed to based on the game script. Arizona was down two possessions most of that second half and needed to throw, and he got some passes in his hands and he held on to them. I think the concept of the kickoff, I think one of our friends likes to bring up, and I think there is a point to it where I think it's a little bit silly how complex we've made this play, which used to be you sit, you kick, they take it back if they want to. And now you've got rules where, oh, if it lands before the 20, it's this. If it lands inside the 20, it's that. If it lands in the end zone, it's this. If it goes out of bounds, it's that. If it's muffed, it's this. If it lands here, but it's not touched, it's that. If I fair catch and I don't do this, and it's that. And also giving the ball at the 40, the 35-yard line, that to me is ridiculous. Letting certain teams, and obviously I'm not going to sit here and try and like minimize because this is an incredible skill, but let's say you're the Dallas Cowboys, you get a ball at the 35-yard line. If you gain 11 yards, you're in field goal range. That's just stupid. I think when you look at maybe what football has always been in, I think you're almost doctoring scores to try and say, look at us, look at how great our league is. We have more points. Because I think what they've done with some of this is ridiculous. And oh, we want to see more kickoffs. I don't understand it. I'm not a fan of it. And I think there needs to be a rethink again that maybe makes it simpler and stops giving people the football at the 40-yard line, at the 35-yard line. Like, if it's a penalty, I get it. You know what? You kicked it out of bounds. You've got 50 yards wide worth of a field. You miss it, you miss it. But I think we're going a little overboard in this kind of just hard on to try and bring the kickoff back. It's weird.
Yeah, my counter argument is if you're an NFL kicker, you should be able to kick it inside the 20-yard
Completely
line
agree.
without a wink in your eye. And
Completely agree.
while I agree that like when it first happened, I didn't necessarily care for the additional complexity. Is it's now year two, it's now a part of the game, and these teams and players have had a chance to, and above all else, the coaches have had a chance to teach their teams the rules and how best not to put it at the 40-yard line. Wow, I don't like the like in-season excuses for it, but would I hate it if at the end of the season it's like the year they made pass interference reviewable. Like, okay, bad idea. Let's quickly get that out in the season, though. It is what it is for that
Sure.
season.
Of course. I agree with that. We're not changing things in season. I do agree that the coaches should be teaching their players, this is what the rule is, and this is how I want you to approach it. Because obviously, maybe people have to, maybe your defense is so good, you don't care if they get it at the 35 or the 40 because you trust the defense to stop them. And so you say, don't kick it to anybody, kick it out of bounds for all I fucking care, because I don't want my special teams giving up a 7-pointer before my defense even gets on the field. Versus if you're Brandon Aubrey, who can sit there and automatically do whatever the hell he wants, and Brandon just hit the knuckleball at the 10-yard line every single time, and maybe we get him muff, maybe we get him down at the 10. Obviously, there's differences based on who your kickers are, but From a conceptual standpoint, and maybe what football has always been, I don't like the idea of letting somebody get 11 yards and ending up in field goal range. That to me is stupid. And yes, I'm aware that the kickers being good is just as much of a part now of that being a problem as this kickoff rule is. But that was my takeaway from the Arizona game. The Cardinals continue to just be a losing franchise and find new ways to lose football games. Sunday morning, I guess, yeah, let's go to Sunday morning because the Pittsburgh Steelers and Mike Tomlin are, I'm not even going to say that they've had a deal with the devil. I think Mike Tomlin just is the devil. The team is 3-1. They beat the Vikings. DK Metcalf actually looked all right, which is kind of new for them this season. And I think where I was going to go with the other part is, the Steelers are going to fuck around and win this division. Joe Burrow's dead. Lamar Jackson's got a hamstring injury, and the Baltimore Ravens defense is dead. And the Cleveland Browns are the Cleveland Browns. So not only are the Steelers going to continue their record of I'm over 500, they're going to win the division and host a playoff game. And I don't think they're a very good football team on top of that. They win these things. I don't understand it.
It's rather ironic that they're what, 4 years removed now from being the worst 12-0 team all time.
Yep.
Are they the worst 3-1 team of all time?
Maybe not, because I'm sh but I know where you're going with it.
But I mean, on the other end is like, oh, TJ Watt is healthy. Okay. I thought he had gotten hurt last week.
That was Nick Bosa, but
Bosa, yeah, right. On the other end, Carson Wentz, like, had the most Carson Wentz game of all time, like, had his two interceptions and didn't, like, look like a very smart person, for lack of a better way to put it, when I put it in my head, but ended up throwing two touchdowns when it mattered, 350 yards. I know he threw the ball like 100 times, but did you see enough that you think he's probably the guy moving forward, or?
I think what they need to do is see what happens against the Browns. I think they probably always planned on using this little European trip as the tryout for Carson Wentz and saying, hey, you know what? If you go win two of these games, you're a quarterback. You go lose two of these games, we're bringing JJ back. And if you go 1-1, we can make the decision based on your play. I guess he has that to figure out this upcoming Sunday, but it's tough just because JJ looked so bad in seven of those eight quarters before the injury. So I kind of go back and forth.
I think he's eventually going to get another shot as a first round pick, but
Oh, I'm not saying that yet. We're not ending his career. I'm just saying in general of like until basically in the sense of can Carson Wentz utilize this injury as a way of galvanizing himself and becoming a starting quarterback and potentially giving himself a chance to be a starter somewhere in 26.
oh,
I
yeah,
don't
okay.
know. That's kind of where I thought you were leading the discussion. I guess it depends. And I think that the answer is the same. It depends on if you go out and lose to the Cleveland Browns. I don't care how good their defense is. If you lose to the Cleveland Browns, you can't be a starting quarterback in the league.
Especially when, well, I guess that kind of gets us into the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah. Little Sunday 1 o'clock game.
The Lions 34, Browns 10. It's time for Joe Flacco to not be playing in the
And I
NFL
think
anymore.
they already said that Dylan Gabriel is set to start the next week. So I think they have made the move, but there's honestly not much to say about this game. Because the Browns' offense is just not good enough to complement the defense against a good team on the road, where it's like we let the Browns hang around for a decent bit. Or maybe you can, if you want to put it the flip side, the Browns' defense kind of had our number at times where the run game couldn't totally get going. They were maybe not getting to Goff, but they were making Goff slightly uncomfortable with some of those pressures. Myles Garrett is ridiculous. But at no point did you ever think the game was in danger because that offense sucks. So,
The offense sucks, but the defense is genuinely elite.
oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You mentioned the run game. This is something I screenshotted today. These are the longest rushes that Browns have allowed this season. There's 10 on this list.
Okay.
Jahmyr Gibbs, 24 yards. Jahmyr Gibbs, 22 yards. Jahmyr Gibbs, 9 yards. Detroit's Jacob Saylor's 9 yards. Green Bay and Manuel Wilson, 9 yards. Jahmyr Gibbs, 8 yards. Jahmyr Gibbs, 8 yards. Jahmyr Gibbs, 8 yards.
That's actually incredibly impressive. I love that stat. And it's very telling. And yeah, they need to figure that out quickly because that defense is insane. And as Myles Garrett ages, they might not have time to wait to get an actual quarterback. And
Yeah.
I don't believe that Dylan Gabriel or Shedeur Sanders, I can't even believe I'm saying that name, are the answer at quarterback. I think they're a team that's probably actively tanking for a Lenorus Sellers or a, dare I say, Dante Moore if he wants to come out this year because he's eligible to, or I mean, Garrett Nussmeier's playing his way out of contention for a top pick, but if the Browns end up in a spot where they feel comfortable to take a quarterback, they're going to have extra picks with the Jags that they can give themselves hopefully a chance to make use of this defense before Myles Garrett ages out of relevance, or at least the status that he is right now is maybe the best or second best edge rusher in football. The one thing that I actually will give credit to on the offensive side for the Cleveland Browns is Quinshon Judkins. He looks insane. We have a good run defense. DJ Reader has kind of gotten back to more of the Cincinnati levels of play, not exactly his play last season. Tyleek Williams makes plays here and there, and I think has been pretty good in the run game, though I'd like to see a little bit more out of him kind of disrupting the passer from the inside, though he's got time to figure that out. We've bottled up some decent running backs. And here comes Judkins being knowingly the only piece of that offense that can even remotely scare you. And he moved it on us. He kind of looks like Nick Chubb reborn. You kind of watch the way he runs. And I think that's another thing that the Browns can say we have a cornerstone as long as he can stay out of trouble off the field because he kind of got out his get out of jail free card when he bought his way out of those charges.
I guess the only other kind of mention on defense is the injury status. You have Terry Arnold and DJ Reed, just like you mentioned. I know Hutchinson seems to be fine now, but went down for a piece of that game as well. Scary because this is exactly what happened last year, not even this early. And like you had mentioned, DJ Reed had kind of come back and really cemented himself on this team and made a good role for it this year. And it seems like he's going to be out for. Has he been placed on the IR yet?
I haven't seen that it's official, but I saw that they were like it's the most likely scenario that he lands on IR, whereas Arnold was more of a, you know what, we'll look at you week to week and maybe you sit because the Bengals fucking suck and you can come back afterwards. But yeah, I know that I was kind of typing up Twitter storms, not exactly, but I saw that the Seattle Seahawks were potentially going to make Tariq Woolen available in a trade. If DJ Reed is actually going on IR and you've already lost Ennis Rakestraw and Terry Arnold's banged up, and by the way, Terry Arnold, even before he was banged up, was still
Was
committing
bad.
penalties in that game. So if that's kind of your cornerback room right now and you're going to sit there and say, you know what, I've got Amik Robertson and Brian Branch, who really both operate as slot corners, if they're going to be a corner because Brian Branch is a safety, I think you need to call Seattle for Tariq Woolen if you're going to be looking at extended period of time away from the field if for DJ Reed. So that's something that I would hope that Brad Holmes gets aggressive for. We know he won't. He's a very passive in-game manager, but you know what? Let a guy help.
Around the rest of the NFL,
The Giants, your boys, they've got some life.
the Giants, the Jackson Dart era is upon us in New York, and we are excited. He looks good against a good team too, in the Chargers. He just brought some energy, and the stat line wasn't
Stat
great.
line's ugly.
It wasn't pretty. He just brought energy, and that's kind of what he brought at Ole Miss. Obviously, he put up numbers at Ole Miss, but he's an energy guy. You could see this team wanted to play for him, and Brian Daboll loved him. All those comments and stuff were basically like, this is the guy that's going to save my job and give me one more year here in New York, and maybe it will. And it's a fun young team because, like, you had Dart do that. Scatterbo has been impressed. Dart can run the ball himself. You have neighbors who didn't have a great game, but you have some
Well,
young.
Neighbors tore his ACL. So,
Did
yeah, I was going to
he?
actually let you
That.
finish and then say, in typical Giants fashion, you get one step forward, you take one step back.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, Neighbors went up for a deep pass near the sideline. And when he came down, he went straight for his knee. Like you knew it was torn the moment or actually before the card even came out. You can just kind of tell sometimes how players react for a tear versus maybe just oh, I banged my knee or something. He's punching the ground. You can kind of see the emotion. So yeah, Malik Nabers is out for the season.
You didn't say yes like Tariq Hill did.
We'll get to that, but I just think that I bring this up every time that somebody dies on a field, and especially that field. How
Yeah.
is MetLife still allowed to use that shit turf? For reference, every single time they play a summer soccer game at MetLife, they bring new grass in, so the players play on grass. For the FIFA World Cup, FIFA is mandating they play on grass. Yet for football, because I don't know if it's John Mara and Mr. Harris or Mr. Johnson are just too cheap or what their stupid excuse is, but the fact that that turf is still allowed to be used, the fact, why do you go out there? It's called Death Life. People have a name for it because that many ACLs get torn on it, and
Yeah.
that many Achilles. I don't have you mentioned. Kudos to you for screenshotting the rushes stat with the Browns, but I saw a stat and I should have screenshot it. It was talking about all the guys that have torn an ACL just on that field in the last like 3 years, and it's like an 8-person list. That's not normal.
That
So
is normal.
I don't understand, and like you're clearly able to bring grass in there for other events. Why can't you do it and try and keep your players healthy? I don't understand how it works. What kind of politics need to be played to the right players or to the right kind of contributors or owners or whoever makes these decisions? But if you're an important enough player, can't you go to John Mara, or if you're a Jets important enough player, can't you say, listen, we can't play like this, and we need this to change. And just if it doesn't, I don't understand it. It's ridiculous.
Almost got to be like a fight from the union because, like,
I agree with
obviously,
that. Yeah.
not every team plays there every year, but you have two teams that play there, and then obviously other teams play there because they have to play those two teams. Is your chances are so high of playing there in a given season because there's already two teams that play there that there should be some kind of union push.
Agree. I guess, I mean, Titans, Texans, I don't really want to talk about the game because the game was awful.
Yeah.
I just think this is about Brian Callahan and how he should not be an NFL coach past this season or maybe even past this week.
Yeah.
They changed their play caller after week three, and the new player goes and gets shut out. You have Cam Ward in the press conference with his lack
Yeah.
of PR training going, we ass.
Yep.
Which I actually kind of like the fact that there's some like,
The full quote was very actually like a
oh, it was
leader.
good. Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily want to stop it at we ass, because you're right. There was accountability. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to sit there and say we suck without throwing out like ways that we can get better. But I love the fact that he didn't go the political answer the way maybe a Patrick Mahomes would. He just comes out there and he's like, we ass. I thought that was hilarious. On the flip side, the Houston offensive line, did you see the clip where Stroud got hit by Jeffrey Simmons after the snap?
Yeah, that was bad.
They timed it from when Stroud gets the ball to when Jeffrey Simmons first puts his hand on him was 0.21 seconds.
Wow.
That is outrageous. That shouldn't be possible. Not to mention that game, and I think it ended, what, 26 to nothing or something.
Yeah.
It was 6-0 going into the fourth. That
Yeah.
was not some classic romp where you just decided to shut it down in the second half. The Texans suck. And then because they're the Texans, your key offseason addition was Cam Robinson, who you didn't even dress against the Titans, and you proceed to trade away. I am an absolute hands in the air, shoulders shrug. I have no idea what they're doing. Do they hate CJ Stroud and they want him to die? Do they not want to pay him a second contract, so they're going to make him look bad so they have an excuse to not give him one? What they're doing to him with this offensive line is incredible. Yeah, there's not exactly actual football to talk about. It's just stupid moments. I mean, I can go to Patriots, Panthers, which wasn't exactly a football game, but the Patriots kind of jumped on the Panthers early, never looked back. They played a clean game because coming off those five turnovers, they needed to play a clean game and they managed that. Drake May, is looking very good for somebody who
Yep.
doesn't really have a true wide receiver. I know Stephon Diggs is working his way back from an ACL injury, but he's also older and not the guy he was in Buffalo, not the guy he was in Minnesota. So you're looking at a guy who's playing a very high level of quarterback play with, I'm not going to say minimal support, but with less than average support. You've got, on the flip side, Bryce Young is probably playing his way out of a starting job in 2026. I think depending on where these Panthers end up and how the rest of the season goes, he absolutely gets kind of Justin Fields in a sense where they're just going to say, you know what, we're restarting the quarterback contract. You know what, Bryce, it's unfortunate. You know, maybe we didn't give you all the help. Maybe the offense wasn't great. The defense we know sucks. Maybe we didn't get you a receiver soon enough. Tet looks good, but maybe it's too little too late for you, but we need to reset the contract because we can't be paying you $40 million while we're a bad team. So you're probably looking at Bryce Young playing his way out of the league. I mean, Eagles, Bucks, the Eagles just kind of keep finding ways to win. This time they get a punt return that gets blocked, or a punt that's blocked for a touchdown return. And then in the second half, they don't complete a pass, but somehow they win the football game. So that's just kind of what the Eagles have turned into.
On the other side, though, the Bucks kind of, and I think they're a good football team, is they've kind of relied on this Baker
Yep.
Mayfield second half heroic stuff, and
Agree.
it's only I think last week we talked about the injuries too, but they keep on piling up for them. They don't like have the personnel at the current moment right now to be able to rely on this, and you just weren't going to be able to do it against the Eagles anyways, so.
Yeah. Chiefs, Ravens, you've got some of the most successful regular season teams the last 5 years. They meet up in a battle to not be 1-3.
Crazy.
The Chiefs get Xavier Worthy back, immediately put him to use. 8 targets, 2 rushes, 120 all-purpose yards. He was their leading rusher on, I think, only or on the 2 rushes.
And
The
receiver.
offense looked better. But I'm not going to sit here and kind of proclaim them as back just because this Ravens defense is beyond banged up.
Trouble.
They're already down 7 starters. Matabuke is out for the season with his neck injury. You law I mean, Jaire Alexander, you knew was going to be injured coming into the season just because he's been glass for the last 3 years. But you know what? The wins are the wins. The Chiefs get to 2-2. And with the help of the Giants, you're just one game behind the Chargers now, with a game still to play against the Chargers in Arrowhead. You're still going to get Rashee Rice back, so there's going to be another level of this offense to kind of unlock and see again. On the flip side, the Ravens, not only is the defense banged up, Lamar Jackson exits that game with a hamstring injury. I haven't actually seen anything about how serious it is, but hamstrings linger, especially for a quarterback that has a little bit of an identity as a mobile quarterback. So I guess we'll see there.
Yahoo Fantasy had him as doubtful because he was projected 4 points.
Yeah,
Not that
and
that's an actual injury report.
yeah. But I mean the flip side, or not the flip side, but the other thing with the Ravens and especially this defense being dead is when you go down and let's say 2 scores the way they were for the majority of that second half, Derrick Henry is useless. Because Derrick Henry does not have a presence or a major presence in the pass game. Derrick Henry's not going to run real routes. He might catch a dump off, but he's not running real routes. Derrick Henry can't really play the hurry up offense. That's a Justice Hill role. And it completely neutralizes him. He had 8 carries in the entire game, and I think he might have only had 2 touches overall in that second half, as they kind of fell behind and needed to start throwing. And if that defense doesn't get better, and if Lamar is hurt, I think you're going to sit there and you're going to not be able to use such a key player and such a guy who's such a good front runner. We know how dangerous that team is with a lead because who's going to take off running? Is Lamar going to keep it? Is Derrick Henry just going to run down my throat and stiff arm my linebacker into the underworld? We don't know, but you know that they're going to run it down your throat. But when they're playing from behind and, you know, obviously Lamar's not as polished as a passer as he is as efficient as a runner. And you force him to throw, you can take advantage of this team. And with the injuries, I think the Ravens season could get pretty ugly pretty quickly. They need to get their players back. I think there's really much more to say there. Like, cool for the Chiefs on getting that win, but against that Ravens defense that now gives up points for fun and just leaks, I mean, what kind of takeaways can we really have? Bears Raiders. Bears continue, or the Bears parlayed their win against the Cowboys, and they turned it into a win against the Raiders with, once again, another blocked field goal. Ashton Gentry went back to his old Michael Myers stance and immediately had a breakout performance, so that was pretty cool. But turnovers on the Raiders' side kept Chicago in the game and ultimately killed them. I would say Caleb, I think, looked pretty good. His offensive line didn't exactly keep him clean. I mean, Max Crosby at times was living in the pocket, but he went through his progressions. He made the correct reads and he made the correct decisions, most importantly. He took off when he needed to take off. He threw it away when he needed to throw it away. And he extended a play when he needed to extend a play. But it wasn't the classic USC where the second he feels any sort of pressure, it's I'm going to turn around and run 15 yards backwards because I'm faster than the defensive end who's chasing me. So I like that. I mean, they're 2-2. I'm not going to sit here and say they're exactly a good team because I don't believe the Cowboys and the Raiders are really good measuring
Right.
sticks, but good for Chicago. Football's fun in that city again.
Yeah.
Rams, Colts. I mean, the Colts finally lose a game. I think Stafford's playing out of his mind, might
Yep.
be an early MVP candidate, maybe alongside a Josh
Josh
Allen.
Allen.
Puka Nacua,
Oh man, he was hard to he was like borderline impossible to tackle for most of that game.
yeah, he might be the best receiver in football right now. Maybe.
Because Justin
Maybe.
Jefferson and Ja'Marr Chase don't have quarterbacks right
Yeah.
now.
And again, they've built up a lot of cash for what they've done at the college and the NFL level, but I think at some point, like, you also do have to factor what's actually happening, and maybe
Yeah.
it's more so on the Ja'Marr Chase side. He's missed time. His
Yeah.
quarterback always misses time, and it affects him. Like, it's obviously not a slant to his talent, but the production's the production. And Puka Nacua, especially when you consider his start of his career to now, and it's a smaller sample size than the other two, but I think he's got like the third or fourth highest yards per game in NFL history.
Wow.
He's ridiculous. Adonai Mitchell, on the other hand, is not ridiculous. He does the cardinal sin of dropping a football as you try and cross the goal line.
Crazy, it still happens.
Yeah, and then he also costs his team a second touchdown, and he gets called for a holding flag on a Jonathan Taylor touchdown run. I mean, yeah, you kind of say it. In 2025, how are these players still not finishing a play? What is so important about celebrating 0.4 seconds early? What are you doing? I think the other thing that was funny for the Colts, and this is maybe not funny, but a miss, just kind of a mistake. But on the long touchdown pass to Tutu Atwell near the end of the game, the Colts only had 10 guys on the field, and one of those 10 players fell down. So you kind of look and you wonder why
Oh
is
yeah, I
Tutu
did see that.
Atwell so open? It's because there was effectively two players less on defense than there was on the offensive side. So Rams win there. Yeah. I think I'm going to mention the Jaguars and the 49ers, or the 49 IRs, as we like to call, for one play or for one specific thing only. At one point, Juwan Jennings got hurt and left the game, but he could not enter the medical tent because Ricky Pearsall was already in the medical tent getting looked at. Like, this just, I don't understand what Kyle Shanahan does to this team in the summer, but they get injured like it's their job.
Yeah.
It used to be maybe be more geared towards the running backs, but it's every level, every position group, offense, defense, receivers, running backs, linebackers, defensive linemen, safeties, all of them get hurt. I don't know what kind of suicide drills he's putting them through in camp, but the 49ers need to have a rethink with their medical department, because you can't just keep doing that. I think game of the week, Packers Cowboys. I think that's probably a pretty simple call.
Yeah.
It was awesome. The Parsons story obviously dominated headlines, but the
Dominated.
on-field stuff was great. Josh Jacobs was pretty filthy on the ground. Dak Prescott played a very, very composed game, and without CeeDee Lamb, still looked incredible. He took his shots to a George Pickens. He found Jake Ferguson as kind of your Sam Laporta chain mover when he needed to. You had The Cowboys, another blocked kick. They take an extra point back for the rare 2-point safety on an extra point. And it kind of gave Dallas life. It was kind of right before the end of the half. Then on top of that, a silly Jordan Love turnover gives Dallas the ability to go ahead into the half. And then in the second half and going into pretty much overtime, it was just the teams alternating scores. It was just touchdown here, touchdown there, field goal here, field goal there, touchdown, 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 touchdown. And you go into overtime where, again, more field goals. I think the game script here called for a lot of passing, but I do think George Pickens showed you he is able to be a number one receiver when he is focused on being a receiver and not focused on fighting whoever is lined up directly opposite him. I think the game ended in the second highest scoring tie in NFL history. It was a scoregami for those who keep track. I think that the Packers played that game a little conservatively, and I think you maybe can look around and say, why aren't you taking shots at the end zone? And actually, now that as I'm sitting here talking about shots at the end zone, the Packers should have lost that game outright in regulation, where I think there's 18 seconds left, and they get a first down, and they have a timeout, if I'm not mistaken. And they're just sitting around looking like, what do we do? And then that's like, maybe we spike it, but they don't spike it. They line up and run a real play, and Jordan Love throws it off I want to say it was like it hit maybe the upright and bounced on the ground with like a second left. And they should have probably lost that game because they got lucky the ball hit the ground sooner than it did. Because if it had bounced up in the air, clock hits zero before the play's dead, and you lose. So I think the Packers have a little bit of growing up to do, and it's no longer
Definitely.
a Jordan Love thing. It's not a just Jordan Love thing. I think Matt LaFleur needs to be a little bit more decisive. I think he at times is just, ooh, Willie here, Willie there. And so, I mean, this is good for the Lions. A mere 20 days after we get just bombed by the Packers at Lambeau, we're suddenly in sole position of first.
Right.
I don't think there's much more about that specific game, but I thought it
Penguins are
was,
just a weird team in general.
so much fun to watch, though.
Very fun to watch. The offense has been, and like you mentioned, without CeeDee Lamb, the offense has been like cooking at pretty much
Yeah,
every week.
surprisingly fine enough.
And like not
Oh,
just this week, like every week.
the last thing I want to mention, this is more on the gambling side. A friend of mine won, I think, $1,200 with the Micah Parsons sack in overtime, which honestly might not have even been a sack. I think Prescott actually made it back to the line, and I think it might have just been a tackle, but it got called a sack. It got recorded as a sack, and that was the last thing my friend needed in some like 20-leg parlay on that game. And he won $1,200.
You gotta keep that thing quiet because they will sometimes go back and change that.
Well, that's what I kind of told him. I was like, "Hey, man, like you better sweat this out for the next like 24 hours because Vegas might give a call and say, hey, man, like we're going to lose a lot of money if you guys don't turn this into just a tackle for loss or tell him it was a designed quarterback run or something and take away the ability to call a sack." But yeah, I think he's in the clear now. I haven't seen him complain about them pulling money out of his account. So good for him there. But yeah, to the Monday night games, which they fucking sucked. Obviously you can't predict this in advance, but Dolphins, Jets, both 0-3 on a Monday night football just doesn't need to be the case. And yes, we can flex things later in the season. We really don't flex games this soon, but the fact that that was a prime time game, like that's got to be a 1 p.m. kickoff on the CW network. That can't even be on Fox or CBS. The Dolphins save Mike McDaniel's job for now. You lose Tyreek Hill for the season. It was referred to as a dislocated knee, and I'll actually give credit. He already got a surgery and he's already starting recovery.
Is he really?
Yeah,
All right.
they said his surgery was successful already with, I guess, whatever torn ligaments he had, and that his goal is to get back to playing football week 1 of next season. How realistic that is, I don't know, but I mean, let's say the Tank Dell thing. It took Tank Dell like 3 months to get his surgery after that gruesome injury last season.
Yeah,
So
so what, I'm not being a doctor, is that just certain times it's too inflamed
I
and
have no clue. I'm not a doctor either. Maybe it depends on what you've actually torn. Because I think, if I remember correctly, like Tank Dell was like one ligament away from his leg being in genuinely two places, because
Sure.
at that point, like, I think that was the only thing holding it together. So I don't recall what it was or why he had to wait so long. But like Tyreek Hill, you had the picture of him in the hospital bed. He's like surgery successful. Like you said, this guy never lost a moment of either heat or kind of moxie, if you will. He's sitting there with his leg on backwards, talking shit from the medical cart, and it's like, dude, like, how are you this happy?
I know. It was just a while. He was like, yes.
Yeah, I've never seen someone that happy as their legs doing origami, but more power to him. The other Monday night game, also pathetic. And again, you cannot plan for Joe Burrow to miss the game, but the Bengals suck. They're on a speed run to awful. You look at this Jake Browning thing, and I kind of mentioned where he'll have a couple of chances to show whether he's good enough to be a back or an extended backup again after he did it 2 years ago. And you either then make the decision of we shut down Joe Burrow for the year and we tank for a high draft pick and maybe we're drafting Alabama wide receiver Caden Proctor. I don't know if did you see that.
No.
Oh, so I'm kind of sad that I have to explain it because it ruins the joke. But Caden Proctor's obviously their left tackle and he's like 6'8 and 370 pounds. And for some reason, Kalen DeBoer split him out wide to his ex receiver and he threw him a pass.
Oh, yeah.
And so maybe the Bengals are taking Alabama receiver Caden Proctor, but I think that this team is very bad at they borderline openly quit that game. Chase Brown can't get anything going without maybe the threat of a passing game to kind of keep teams farther back. And Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins are more or less neutralized with this. And to be fair, the Broncos are a good defense, but the Bengals are going to be losing a lot more games. And what I thought maybe is a chance for them to just stay afloat until Burrow comes back and maybe they have to do their classic win the last three games of the season to go 10-7. I don't see that happening. I think this team
Yeah.
gets knocked out very quickly with the way they're playing and with the way they look.
And they're gonna have to play us on Sunday, and
Oh,
yeah.
as a guy who owns both Jahmyr Gibbs and David Montgomery in our Dynasty League, I'm starting both of those guys and I fully expect us to run all over them.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for that. But yeah, that's kind of the NFL rundown. I think actually we probably went through every single game at least in some form. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Might be one of the longer episodes we've had in maybe since the last time football was a thing at the end of 24. But if you made it this far, thank you very much. You can't see me in this dimly lit Ohio room, but this was kind of a nice reprieve from the day of testing we had where some things didn't maybe go so well. And so I'm gonna say go green. Hopefully they can get back on track and snipe a Nebraska game. That's
On
obviously
the road.
blissful thinking, but you know what? Give us something to cheer about, man.
Have you seen the spread?
Yeah, it's like 10.5 or something.
So, yeah, I saw it at 11 and a half.
I mean, again, I'm blissfully thinking because this defense isn't stopping anybody.
Yeah.
But what are you gonna do, man?
Yeah.
They can lose that game, and then the only thing I'll care about is the Michigan game. But you know what? If they win it, maybe I'll care about UCLA.
Yeah, because they'd be 5-1 at that point.
They'll lose to Indiana beforehand. They'll be 5-2 into the Michigan game if they find a way to snap this Nebraska thing. But that's neither here nor there. We'll talk about that next week. This time, I'm gonna go have a fun time in France. So my last words are go green.
Je m'appelle. Bonjour.